I've talked to a lot of interesting people here, but I have to admit, I found myself just so excited for this one. I am like an adventurer at heart. And so today's interview with marine biologist, storyteller, Paul Nicklin. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so marine biologist, storyteller is kind of what I came up with as a description to sum up like crazy resume that includes National Geographic contributor, Sea Legacy co-founder, award-winning photographer, filmmaker, author, marine biologist. I'm curious, like, how you would introduce yourself at an event where you had to talk about your resume, and like, how would you sum it up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I appreciate it. I think probably would be nowadays would be a conservationist. Because I'm using the power of storytelling to drive a global movement towards caring about our planet and specifically our oceans. But yeah, it has been an evolution. It had, I started living in Baffin Island, a place where I understand you might be going to see narwhals and belugas, but out there on the floe edge, and I lived with the Inuit. I never had a telephone or radio. Didn't have a television, so I spent all of my time outside with the Inuit and then fell in love with the Arctic and became a biologist, worked on polar bears and lynx and different wild animals, and slowly realized that I would serve the world better by evolving into a photographer trying to bridge the gap between the important issues surrounding our planet and a global audience by working for a magazine like National Geographic. And it's like sort of almost making the NFL, but there's only one team. Like, if they fire you from National Geographic, there's no place to go. And so it was a terrifying, humbling experience working amongst some of the best photographers in the world. But I had a skill that separated me from everyone else at National Geographic. And the one skill I had was I'm really good at being frozen and miserable. And just, when you lose all feeling in your hands and your feet and you're covered in frostbite, that doesn't mean you stop working. That means you're in the right spot, and you're. So that's sort of the path. I got sort of pigeonholed at National Geographic as the cold weather specialist. And then from there, I got really focused on climate change stories, doing a lot of their climate change stuff in Antarctica and the Arctic. And then that was in 2014 that we launched Sea Legacy and went more specifically into conservation storytelling to really drive traffic to the important issues affecting our planet.
You played like right into my next question. So what is the coldest temperature you felt? And where was it?
Coldest temperature, probably minus, I mean, if it's Fahrenheit, probably close to a minus 100. It's so not so much that you are it that the the ambient temperature is minus 60, but then you're on a snowmobile doing 40 or 50 miles an hour through the night. Like when I was running my research trap lines and stuff like that, or being caught in a blizzard. But yeah, minus 40 was nothing, to the point that minus 40 feels pretty good. Minus 50 is getting pretty cold. On one expedition, it never got above minus 48 Celsius, which is something like close to 60, for it never got warmer than that for a week straight. Like, I was out working on my snowmobile, snapping bolts with wrenches because it's metal's cold, like everything's brittle. And but it's again, it's the world I know, and I'm more scared of the heat for sure.
It's like Lambeau Field in the middle of winter. You would survive out there. But
Until I
it
got
was
hit.
funny. Yeah, exactly. We had talked about doing an interview a month or so ago, but you were about to sail across the Pacific from Mexico to French Polynesia. So did you get your land legs back, since being back there? And you've been
Yeah,
back
it
for
was
what,
an
a week or something?
amazing time to, in this world, like, as you know better than anybody with your schedule and working with Tom and this world we live in now, with a million different ways to connect with people, like just to disconnect and just sail by the wind and your world slows down to 9, 10 knots. And it's such a beautiful time to reconnect with nature, to sit there out at night under the stars. And we had some big storms and we had some rough weather, but we also had a mayday situation. We helped save a guy, and it's exciting. But three weeks across the Pacific from Mexico to French Polynesia, pulled into Fatuhiva, and it was great. But yeah, I have my land legs back, and I'm back onto 28 different devices, and email to e ways to connect and email and text, and now the important work happens.
It was fun to follow you along on the journey with social media and see you guys from working out on the boat to swimming in the water, out there. But I wouldn't be doing my job here as a pretend journalist if I didn't ask about the Mayday call.
Oh, it's more a guy had dismasted. He has a family with his wife and three kids, and they were 500 miles, 800 miles away from Mexico, heading towards and towards French Polynesia. And a storm came up and blew their mast off, and there was a mayday, and an oil tanker picked up his family, and he refused to get off the boat, wanted to see his boat to safety. It's all he had, all his possessions. And so he was working his way north up to the remote group of islands off of 500 miles off of Mexico. And that's where we had found him right when he had dropped the anchor. But we gave him a whole bunch of fuel and a whole bunch of supplies. But I think he was most excited by Hug's conversation. And most of all, we gave him a whole whack of avocados. And he's still on social media talking about those avocados. For some reason, that was what he missed most of all. But he's now back in Mexico, back with his family, and he's fine. And we didn't save him, but we were part of, you know, a huge group of community of people who rallied around. And that's the beautiful thing about mariners. You know, once you're out there in the open ocean, you're all a community taking care of each other.
It seems like there's a common thread there, even people like, you know, I was gonna ask about exploration, and like, you know, you go for a hike and it's like, hey, nice to see you. There's always just a good vibe, it feels like. And have you found, like, just meeting new people along the way when it comes to relationships, like, adventure has brought you close to people and you know, made a lot of friends through that?
100%. You know, it's funny, like, you find the young photography community. I've actually heard some Todd podcasts and stuff with Tom Brady and about his leadership on the field and the way he works. And I really learned from that. Because the photography world, as you're climbing the ranks, it's kind of cutthroat. Everyone's sort of trying to get that job, and, you know, they'll break your knees if they have to get ahead of you. And when you finally arrive at National Geographic, it's really an incredible community of people who are the best in the world at what they do. And that humility, and you start to see people who give back, and they're in service to the community, they're in service to people. Like, I love to mentor young photographers. You learn about giving back. And it's funny, though, when I hire assistants now, like when I go into the field, I'll rarely hire another photographer. I'll hire somebody who's played professional sports, somebody who's either been a professional kayaker because their lives depend on one another. I'll hire quite often professional mountaineers, mountain climbers, because their lives depend on one another. So when I'm in a real scary situation, whether it's like 200 feet deep in a cave on a rebreather and things aren't going well, I'd love to know that I have somebody whose job is basically that it's in their DNA to help save you as a teammate. And it's a really nice community to be a part of.
I mean, talking about that, right? Like in your DNA, special sauce, like, what was it? Like, you had such a wild childhood, you know, growing up, you know, Baffin Island and right in the Canada's Arctic Circle, into a National Geographic photographer. Like, the journey is obviously interesting, but more just like, what do you think, like, have you ever pinpointed what's in you that brought you to this point?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. My mom, my parents, my brother, none of them had any interest in any of this. My dad was dead set. I remember one year when I was working as a biologist, I took all these photographs and I finally showed him a show I was so proud of. And he said he had never seen a bigger waste of time and money in his life. And like, wow. You know, go get off and get a job at the government. And it's funny, he passed a few years ago, but as you know, I'd go visit him, you couldn't see an inch of wall space in his house because it was full of my photos. So, you know, it's just sort of like, once they see you show a path of success or achieving your goal or being happy, they're very proud for you. Maybe it's a protective thing. You know, your parents trying to keep you from going down a very uncertain path, especially in arts and, you know, setting yourself up for failure. But I don't know. I don't know what's in me. You know, I really attribute a lot of what I've done in my life to the Inuit. And that is that they, in their culture, they're storytellers. They either tell stories through soapstone carvings, and you'll see that when you head up there, the most beautiful soapstones where they chisel these stories. Like, I have some stuff on my mantle that's from the 70s in Baffin Island, where these two brothers are out hunting for seal, and one brother shoots his first seal, but the older brother's trying to steal it from him, and just really cool storytelling. And the Inuit, we would stand outside at minus 40 under the northern lights, and they would tell these beautiful ghost stories or stories of Kalupilu, the sea monster who is going to steal us off the ice, drown us, and eat us. And so your right brain is just packed full of amazing visual storytelling. And meanwhile, your skill set, the fact that you're outside wearing a t-shirt at minus 40 or a light little jacket with, you know, frostbitten ears, you can't feel your feet, but the story's so good. So you're basically learning these survival skills from the Inuit to be out there on the land and realize what true pain is. You know, when you are that cold, you know, like when you dive under the sea ice and you're there for 45 minutes to an hour, you're entering the initial stages of hypothermia. You haven't felt your face or your hands for 40 minutes. Your body's starting to slow down, but you still keep working to get that shot. So you're sort of in the survival mode, yet you're being an artist, you know, that's trying to get published in the most discerning magazine in the world. You're trying to, you know, they're expecting great results. And so you have that pressure on you. And that's what I kind of love about it. But maybe I don't know what it is. Maybe I froze my brain as a small kid, but I just have a hard time accepting no, or the harder the challenge, or the more pain I am, or the more scared I am, the more worried I am, the more calm I seem to get, and the more I seem to get in the zone and really just focus and be present. And I like that, you know.
You remind me of a certain quarterback. I know it's a lot of those words you could really cross over to the sports world. So it is interesting to see that that crossover there. Obviously, when you're traveling, you bring a camera. Is there something? I know you go on different adventures, whether it's under the sea or on a mountain or, you know, in the jungle. But is there something else you've always taken with you? Is there a little like trinket or something else besides your camera?
Yeah, people ask me that a lot. I don't have. You know, when I'm at sea with all these sailors and just sailing now, like you can't have bananas on boat, you can't whistle, you can't. I'm not one of these guys with superstitions. I'm always trying to bring something that will calm my brain. And I generally have breathing for that. You know, I do a lot of free diving breathe ups where you do 4 seconds in and hold for a second, 8 seconds out. And you do that for, you know, 15, 20 minutes a day. And that makes me feel present and makes me feel full of gratitude. You know, but like, yeah, if I can get lost in I always bring a book. I seem to bring a book everywhere I go. My carry-on has a book, but I almost never read a book. It took me now a month at sea to get through 2 books because just our brains are busy. And but yeah, I like to have a book with me. And you know, the less I went and did this expedition into the high Arctic where I was pretty frustrated with my government job. I didn't like the work we were doing. It was sort of really encouraging the killing of animals for the fur industry. And that was against my ethos. And so I left that job and I just got dropped off in the middle of the Barren Lands. And I said to the pilot, you know, if I'm alive in 3 months, I'll be down here at the ocean. So meet me there in 3 months' time. And sure enough, you know, 3 months later and a little bit later than that, there he showed up in his airplane and picked me up. I'd lost 50 pounds. I had hiked over 1,000 kilometers. I felt more invigorated, alive and free than I'd ever had in my life. And all my stress and worries that I had going into that trip, all my frustration from, you know, working for the government, all that stuff was gone. And I just felt, I don't know if you've read the book, The Untethered Soul, but my soul was untethered at that point. Life was great. And so it's about turning off, disconnecting, connecting with yourself, connecting with your thoughts, with your path, with your goals, with your vision. And just following that and your ethics and your ethos and your values. And that's such a defining trip for me. I need to do another one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me know. I'll join you. I'll stay back away to give you your space. But you know, talking about balance, right? So it's like you go from these crazy places or you go from being alone in the woods to like you have a huge social media following. You have, you know, you need to sell your prints. You need you have a store. Like, how do you go from how do you create that balance in your life? Like, how about this? Let me ask you, where do you feel the most comfortable?
Where
do you feel like, you know what, this feels nice. Like, is it like there at the desk that you're sitting in now? Is it on a mountaintop? Or like, is it like giving a speech? Where do you feel like you're like, this is where I feel, this feels right.
You know, it's funny. I maybe again, this comes from the Inuit, but I love to connect with an audience. You know, I love to be alone at night diving with big sharks or with, you know, if I'm 200 feet deep and it's like, I love feeling vulnerable. I love feeling that there's so much stuff that's bigger than me. I love feeling small in this universe. And so like when I'm diving in a cave system or if I'm deep underwater and I, you know, like I was just alone in Mexico and I was doing this dive and you know, it's one thing to have tiger sharks that are fed that come around, but I had this 14-foot female tiger shark that wanted to hang out with me and she was massive. And just to be sitting there 2 feet away from her, looking in her eyes, she kept circling around me. I love that feeling of being a little bit raw, a little bit out of control. And I, that's what keeps bringing me back to this work, or to be sitting there with a polar bear or a brown bear on a river, you know, with a 1,000-pound bear, and you're 5 feet away from it. And you just have that, you never feel scared, but you feel alive. You feel, so I love that feeling. But it's funny, another feeling that it took a while to get there, but I love speaking to large audiences. I love being on stage to, you know, 3,000-4,000 people, you know, small compared to obviously like a football game, but, you know, just to have 4,000 people emoting and crying together over, you know, a starving polar bear, or laughing out loud at some self-deprecating moment. I love that connection. It's interesting for somebody who grew up kind of shy, you know, in isolation in a remote culture, that I just sort of really have grown to love connecting with large audiences as well, which is probably why I put so much effort into storytelling on social media.
This might come as a surprise, but let's talk photography for a second here. So sure. What was that feeling when you first saw your first photo ever in National Geographic? And what was the photo?
It's funny you asked that. It's a longer story. How much time do you got? Like about almost a...
Hey, it's Friday, baby. Like, we could just go on all day.
Okay. I mean, it was a funny thing. I was trying to get noticed by National Geographic. I was living in Whitehorse, Yukon, and I found out that they were doing a story on the Aurora Borealis. And I kept thinking, like, what skill set do I have that could allow me to shoot? You know, but this is like, again, the NFL, you know, I would go talk to the director of photography. He's like, okay, you think you should shoot for my magazine? Who are you better than? Are you better than Tom Brady? Are you better than Gronkowski? Like, absolutely not. You don't belong here. And I kept thinking, well, I don't belong here yet. You know, so what can I do that nobody else is doing? What's my skill set? Again, I was like, I'm good at freezing. I have no money. I'm young. I'm broke. But I found out that there was a team of NASA scientists building a rocket in Alaska, which was 1,000 miles away from my house. And they were going to launch this rocket 1,100 miles into space to sample the Aurora Borealis. I thought, wow, if I could get a picture of all four booster stages climbing into space and sampling the Aurora, that might make National Geographic, because it's a storytelling image. It's a bit different. You know, I'm not good enough to shoot just a picture of Aurora to beat the top photographers at National Geographic. So got in my truck. I drove there. You know, NASA says, look, we have no money for you, but if you want to follow along and shoot us, shoot our project, you can do that. I said, great. So I went and slept in the front seat of my pickup truck. It was like a bench seat. So I slept there in my minus 50 sleeping bag. And I stayed there for a month, you know, and I slept in the sleeping bag at minus 40. I would go smash tins of beans open with an axe and, you know, I'd heat those up and eat that. And, you know, but waiting for them to launch this rocket. And finally, after a month of this freezing and being miserable, I just said to myself, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is never going to happen. So I got in my truck and I drove all the way back from Alaska to the Yukon, got home, had a shower. I was in bed for maybe an hour. The phone rang and it was the head scientist who said, we are definitely launching that rocket tonight. I'm like, how can you? I've been there a month. And so I got in my truck with no sleep, drove the 1,000 miles, minus 40 in the middle of the winter from the Yukon to Alaska. And as I pull in, they're like, we're lighting it. This is happening. And it's going up in 45 minutes. So I got my cameras all set up the way I'd planned, you know, opened up all the shutter speeds. The Aurora came over, recorded that, and they lit the rocket and got all four booster stages going through the Aurora Borealis as I had sketched on a piece of paper, as I had envisioned, sent those images into National Geographic, and they ended up running that image in the magazine. And that was my first picture. You know, so it's funny, the number one comment I get from people, you know, is like, you're so lucky, you just get to travel the world and take snaps. And I'm like, and I got really in trouble on social media one day. It's like, I said, that's like you saying, hey, Tom Brady, that's like, you know, you're so lucky, you just get to run around on a field and throw a ball around. It's like, but I mean, to compare myself to, I mean, I think it's no secret we probably came together because I'm such a massive fan of Tom's, and you know, I admired his greatness and his leadership and, you know, him as a person for many years. And I don't even follow football, but I don't think I ever missed one of his games. You know, I was one of those guys who switched very quickly from the Patriots to the Bucks, you know, so nice. just to follow him, you know, and, you know, to even compare myself that in that same sense, I think that's why there was so much pushback on social media. It was a really silly, arrogant thing to say, but you know, it's, like anybody who does well in their profession, you work harder than anyone else. You grind it, you take the risks, you push through pain and persevere. And it's the same thing in arts and photography.
I mean, I'm sure, I know it's the same with you, but not to keep comparing back to sports, but like, just from being around Tom and seeing what you see on Sunday is the absolute tip of the iceberg. Like yeah. it's the April, May, like June, like February, when no one's looking in the off season, when you're just grinding away, that's when the photo happens. And so I'm sure it's the same with you. So just a couple quick hits, if you will. First camera.
My mom's Pentax K1000, all manual. She took pictures in the Arctic, and I was in awe of her, but I never thought one day I would be a photographer. And she handed her camera to me late in life. I was 18, took a couple pictures that surprised me. And very quickly I got hooked and bought an Iconus 5 and went underwater and started shooting in the 80s.
Define conservation photography.
Conservation photography is an image that is so visceral and so powerful and so emotive. It's an image that is based on art, science, and conservation. It's an image that will go to live on forever once it's in focus and once it's sharp and properly exposed. That image is now it's time to go to work. And it's an image that will galvanize a global movement to get people to collectively care about an important cause.
Do you see the world through like an 8x10, like in through a lens? Like, and I'm not even making a joke. Like when you're looking or you're outside, are you looking like you're like looking through a camera?
100%. And that's, you know, it actually got difficult for a while as a photographer, as a still photographer, Nat Geo for so many years. Everything I saw, it turned into an image in my mind. If that was backlit, what's the light here? Look at the side lighting, the exposure. How do you make this a beautiful piece of art? And I actually got exhausting mentally to be thinking like that all the time. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I switched to video. I mostly shoot video now for Sea Legacy, for our nonprofit. And that is something that I love, because it's now, if you watch like a BBC special or a National Geographic special, there's almost never a great moment in there that makes for a great still, but it's still a beautiful film. So now I really take a little bit of pressure off myself, and I see life moving as this beautiful motion picture. And sure, there are highlight moments of stills in there that could exist, but I'm not putting so much mental pressure on myself that I have to photograph everything with my mind. So I give myself a little bit of a break.
I gotta ask, does it just like kill you that like you hear all these people, or just you see people think they're like pro photographers with their iPhone? Like everybody thinks they're the next, you know, you with the iPhone.
No, I love it. You know, I it's like, sure, the iPhone has made everybody want to think they're a photographer, but you think of, you know, Black Lives Matter, man, that stuff wouldn't have happened without that phone. And then I think of whether it's shot vertically or horizontal, or if I think of, you know, what really mostly put an end to the Vietnam War was that girl running, burning in napalm, is like an incredibly powerful image. And so I really think photography has that power to create real lasting change. And so if somebody's out there with their phone and they're all learning skills, that's what I do get tired of, is, you know, just why. I mean, when I lived for alone on the Barren Lands for 3 months, I'd go for weeks without anything to shoot. And I never even had the thought. Like, people are like, well, show us pictures. I'm like, well, I'd never turned a camera on myself. I wouldn't even know what that means. And so this thing now of seeing everybody, I'll show people a spirit bear, a rare white Kermode bear along a river in British Columbia that very few people get to see. And then I bring these people and it's like my face and the bear, my me. So that's probably drives me more crazy than, you know, photographers. So I think it's great that people are, we use these iPhones constantly for, you know, image stabilized 4K filming in the field. So it's been a real great tool for us.
Yeah. Last quick hit. Is there like, do you have a dream like place or like dream of like photo that you want to catch, like capture?
Yeah, you told me I was invited to a Bucks game, and that can
no longer. Where
were you? I know. Mean, I was on assignment, and now that dream is sounds like that dream retired. But the Bucks are still driving, and so yeah, I just like being immersed in moments that really, you know, I was just recently in the water with a 100-foot blue whale, the largest animal ever to live on this earth. And to think that they can hold an Olympic sized swimming pool volume of water in one mouthful. So to be next to that underwater is just like, you can't fathom it. Anything that continues to make me feel small, and that's either a big storm or, you know, or to be, I was in the water recently with 60 orcas in a feeding frenzy at night. Like, it was pitch black, but there's orcas everywhere. There's humpbacks rushing by you, you know, anything like that. Heading back to Antarctica, being fed penguins by leopard seals, or, yeah. So anything that continues to to make you feel humble and full of great gratitude.
It's really important to me, a playing field that like the community supports each other. So I really want you to tell us a little bit in a little more detail about Sea Legacy and what's going on there. So make sure that we can link to it and the community can support you.
I really appreciate that, Ben. That's very kind. Yeah. It's funny when you look at the philanthropic pyramid in the United States, $500 billion a year goes to philanthropy, and it's the most philanthropic country in the world, which is amazing. And it goes to a lot of great causes, but you know, at the top of the pyramid is, I think 33% is religion, 18% is health and education. And then you just sort of, you work your way down, and at the very bottom of that pyramid, all these are all important things, but at the bottom of the pyramid is 1.8% goes to the planet. And that includes all the horses, dogs, cats, pets, you know, so it's like, and to the communication arm that really communicates the state of our planet to the rest of the world, that's like 0.2%. And so we need not to necessarily reverse that pyramid, but we really need to drive money essentially to storytelling for our planet, for our oceans. And I think that's what we're so proud of at Sea Legacy, is that we're not just another, there's 5,000 nonprofits in the United States alone doing ocean conservation work. And you know, what we do is we realize that all of them are, most of them are very important, doing good work. So we really try and amplify the work of everyone else. Like, we just launched a fundraiser called 100 for the Ocean, 100 of the best photographers in the world, donating 100 prints total. And 100% of the proceeds go to ocean conservation work. And we've identified partners that we're going to give money to. We're going to help grow their organization. We're going to try and help elevate them. So I think, you know, getting behind an organization like Sea Legacy is a really great one. Just at least go online and start to get educated, start to open up your emotional pores to the state of our planet. And, you know, like, all the stuff is important. All these issues are important, but man, if we don't have functioning oceans, we're in trouble. You know, every second breath we take comes from the sea. It sequesters most carbon. We are a water planet. We are an ocean planet, and we need to take care of it, because we are here in the final hour, and this is our last stand for our planet and the oceans. So people need to start factoring that in their day to day.
Yeah, we'll definitely make sure we link to all that so people can support. People follow you on social media. The content there and the photos are obviously amazing. You have a newsletter. You have a, you know, TED Talk. And then I haven't listened to it, but I saw you, you know, an unbelievable masterclass with over 50 episodes. And there's just a lot of different areas where people can kind of connect with you and learn a lot more, as we're obviously just touching the surface today. But I'm curious about that moment, right? Like, in your career where you're like, I made it. And, you know, is there something that's one moment, one, like, you know, you open up National Geographic or something, you were recognized as somebody that you're like, I made it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and it wasn't ever for an award. It wasn't ever for an accolade. It wasn't ever for anything beyond having a conservation win, where we used to be like, you know, like when we filmed that starving polar bear that got 2 billion views, you know, and viral around the world. And that didn't even result in a win, but it got a lot of eyes on the issue. But, you know, doing these targeted things where I was on stage, I was invited to this event in St. Petersburg, and I'm on stage, you know, it was a Putin event, talking about, he had just said, we need to extract as many minerals and oil as we can from the environment, because, you know, I don't care, this is how we're going to save our country. And he says, I don't care about your polar bears. But I had just led a big campaign in Norway, in Svalbard, to prevent more oil drilling in the most beautiful place in the world. I told you about those 60 orcas in that feeding frenzy. That's where we were able to ban any future exploration and drilling in this area. And just to know that we did that with a concerted strike, working with partners, you know, working with the Sea Legacy model, we were able to ban mile-long drift nets off the coast of California, off of Los Angeles. People don't know that it's there, but there are these mile-long nets that catch dolphins, whales, sharks, because they're targeting swordfish. And to, again, go down, work with partners, get the footage, really risky diving. They were trying to catch us in the boats. You know, put our lives at risk, working way offshore to come back with this footage and to share that with the world, and then to have it, you know, banned at the state level. And then those nets were banned at the federal level. But without those visuals and that storytelling, that never would have happened. And, you know, everybody in LA would have been, or in California would have been against this fishery if they had seen the visuals, and they were once they saw them. So that's when I know that I wouldn't say made it. That's when I know that I'm being value added to the planet. That's when I know that I'm, you know, serving a role, that this has all come to a head at this point in time where, you know, working with my wife, Christina, who's a powerhouse conservationist, to work with her, who's been in this space for 35 years, you know, leading these conservation movements, these wins, it's all come to a head. National Geographic was great, but, you know, to work so hard to have a story there for 1 month and then gone forever, really, you know, after 2 years of effort. But now with social media and other channels, we get to beat this dumb drum daily. And this is another way to do it with your show here. So I really, really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, this will definitely be my hardest interview to end because I have about a billion more questions, but super appreciative of your time today. And beyond that, like, you know, helping us as a community, everybody just see the beauty in the world and sometimes kind of opening the eyes of things that aren't as beautiful, but for change and positive impact. So thanks for the inspiring us, and like, let's all go out there and explore, baby.
Yeah, man, I really, really appreciate it. And I'll get you up to the Arctic sometime. We'll go see some great stuff together, and really great. Great to meet you here face to face. And I really appreciate you having me.